Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
In researching the Jennifer Lewis case, I had stumbled upon a podcast dedicated to the case itself, and I was actually shocked by the amount of information that they were providing. And as I said in the episode, if you get the opportunity to listen to the WVIK Suspect Convictions podcast, I highly recommend it. Anyways, when I stumbled upon the podcast, I just had to interview the people behind it. So after some digging and a few phone calls and emails, I was able to sit down with Scott Reeder. As a former Quad City Times reporter, he followed the Stanley Liggins case all the way from the beginning to the finish, quite literally.
From the cases of missing and murdered in the Midwest, we're digging deeper with guests who see these crimes from the inside out. This is Crime Chat. And here's your host, Toria Wilson.
So, 30 years ago, you were called to just a fire at a Davenport Elementary School, right? By your editor, correct?
That's correct. I was the night cop reporter at the Quad City Times. I was 24 years old. I had a year and a half of experience at another newspaper, and I got dispatched to a small fire at a school playground. It was back in the days when we had the Times had its own vehicles, and we'd drive around from police station to police station and look at reports and interview detectives and do that sort of thing. And I always would carry a police scanner with me and this is before cell phones, a big walkie-talkie that the editors could get a hold of me. And I hear on the scanner, fire at school playground, and I'm thinking, oh, that's just that neighborhood, they have a lot of trash fires, it's no big deal. And then this editor, who always annoyed the hell out of me, he says, Scott, go check that out. And I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. And I get there at the same time as first police officer, and we see the smoke rising from some tall weeds on the edge of the playground, and I'm walking over there with him, and I get about a foot from the fire, and I look down, and instead of being a trash fire, it was a little 9-year-old girl that had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. It was the most horrid thing I've ever seen in my life, and hope I ever do see.
Wow. And you were still a fairly new reporter, correct?
Yeah, I've only been a reporter for about a year and a half, 2 years when that happened.
Wow. And so you arrive, police officer arrives. Do you just kind of like take a step back at that point and you're just kind of, in a sense, shell-shocked? Like you can't believe what you've just seen?
I'm just absolutely shocked. I start feeling the bile rising up in my stomach. Kind of getting weak at the knees, and I kind of stagger back, and I'm just like, what on earth have I just seen? Because she was laying there, spread eagle, she'd been put in a garbage bag, the plastic had melted on her, at that time I couldn't even tell for sure the gender of the child. It was because she was so badly burned, and whoever had done this horrible crime had deliberately poured the gasoline in the genital area to destroy any DNA evidence or anything else. So it was just horrendous. I mean, no sooner did the police officer call back for backup, wanted detectives there right away. You can appreciate this being a journalist. I knew what I needed to do right then is just plant myself there and not move, because I knew as soon as the detectives got there, they're going to put up the crime scene tape, and I was going to be a long way away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started radioing back the details to the newsroom, and detectives, I knew all of them, started showing up. There was Dave Holden, who was a good friend of mine. There was Don Schaefer, who was a lieutenant with the Detective Bureau. There was Ted Carroll, who was a captain with the Detective Bureau. There was Kevin Murphy, who was at the time a corporal with the Detective Bureau. And then there was other people with the ID division, like Denny Kern and others. And it would just be, it just got bigger and bigger. And then the TV station started to arrive. And they set up right next to me. There are tripods, and I've never seen this happen before or since anywhere. We found the body about 9 o'clock, and they started zooming in on the body and doing live shots for the 10 o'clock news. And I mean, I can tell you with all honesty, this is the most horrible thing I've seen in my life anywhere. And suddenly they're taking this incredibly horrible thing and they're projecting it out into everybody's living room at 10 o'clock at night. It was not every, I don't think every station did it, but several did. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty horrendous. And I just kind of worked the scene like, you know, a reporter's supposed to do. The medical examiner was there. I had a really good rapport with him because when I first moved to town from Texas, I didn't have a doctor. And he was old Dr. Paul Beckman was his name. And he became my physician. And whenever I had the flu or something, I'd go to Dr. Beckman, and he liked me. So he started spilling the beans on what he saw to me. He said it was a young woman. I mean, he guessed at the time, I think, that she was 12, and she was actually 10. We started, he was conveying to me what had happened and what he could detect from the body. And then, we talked to the detectives about what's going on. And I just remember the body language of some of the cops there. Dave Holden, who was, as I said, a good friend of mine, I've never seen him that visibly angry at the world. He was just, people react to trauma in different ways, but he was just absolutely enraged that such a thing could happen in his community, on his shift. And he just, I remember him going up to the Channel 6 reporter. No, I take that back. It wasn't Channel 6. I think it was Channel 8. Now I think about it. And saying, do you have a car phone in your van? And they said, yes. And he said, I need to use it. Because this is the days before cell phones were mm-hmm. common. So you had these car phones that were the size of a shoebox that a few news organizations were able to carry. And he needed to call and back to the station and get more assistance and get more technical expertise. And it was just horrible. And it wasn't just seeing this, it was smelling this. It was just, you were really had a sense like you were on a battlefield because you just, what you saw was just so horrendous. And then a print reporter for the competing newspaper showed up and he was very excited. And he saw these reporters standing there, and he came running over, and he almost fell over the body. And I'm like, oh, God. He didn't see the body there. I don't know how you missed that.
Yeah.
And, we're all standing there. I remember there was Lisa Tirado. She was the Channel 4 reporter. She was a little bit younger than me, even. And she's kind of on to be a big-time news anchor in Phoenix. And I was talking to her about a year ago. And she said, Scott, she was just driving through Phoenix with her two sons, and they were on the news, there's some things you can never get out of your mind no matter what. And her son says, have you ever had any cases like that, Mom? And she said, there was this little girl in Rock Island who died. I can never get that out of my mind. I was there when I was 22, and I can't. And she, we didn't know each other particularly well here in the Quad Cities, but the fact that it impacted us the same way and so profoundly, you know, for two people now in their 50s is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
You know, there was Ed Lewis. You grew up in the Quad Cities. You might remember him.
It sounds familiar.
He had a big booming voice that he was with Channel 6 at the time.
That rings true now.
Yes. And he's now passed on. But what I remember was when I was doing the interview with Dr. Beckman, he kind of snuck up behind me and listened over the shoulder with his microphone up. And then he excitedly got in onto the live shot and said, "And this is what I've learned." And then before he finished his live shot, my editor calls me on the walkie-talkie. "Ed Lewis has this. Did you know this?" And I just hand the walkie-talkie over to Ed, and he says in his big booming voice back to the Quad City Times, "Yeah, Scott had it first. I was just listening in on his interview."
Journalism.
Yes. And, you know, but, you know, so I just kept radioing in details, and they were writing the story back in the paper. And then it sounds so strange now in the internet era, but suddenly when, you know, the newscasts all happened, and then they stopped, and the TV reporters were just standing there. And then we time for the paper to go to press, we put it to bed. Then I'm just standing there. And it's like, well, what can we do now? Well, you know, there's no newscast left. There's no print edition. It's not like we can, it's not like today where you would just post it on the internet, continual updates. It's like, well, I guess we can go home, you know. Well, yeah, but do we really want to leave yet? You know, she's still laying there. And then you hear on these squawks on the police radio that there's a child missing in Rock Island. This is, of course, the Jefferson School in Davenport. And the rumor starts going around that this missing child in Rock Island may be the child. And they take the girl to, I think it was Mercy Hospital at the time, which is now, I believe it's Genesis, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they have a medical examiner get there, and they fingerprint her, and they take a police officer over to the school in Rock Island that she attends, and they go to her desk and pull out her textbook and compare the fingerprints. And then they figure out that, yes, that child is indeed Jennifer Lewis.
Wow.
And it was incredible. And then, of course, you know, we started learning more about her.
Yeah.
She'd grown up in really, really tragic circumstances. Her dad had been in jail, her stepfather had been in jail for selling look-alike drugs. While her dad was in jail, her mom was selling cocaine for a man by the name of Stanley Liggins.
Yeah.
And he was marketing it to Rock Island, and she was selling it. And so he was coming and going from the house all the time. And he's a very bad man. He's done some really horrible things. But he'd make over her every time he came in. You know, like he'd tousle her hair, or he'd play a little game with counting change, or he'd do these different things. And it's just this presence that's there. I mean, the father gets released from jail, he's there, and there's always meeting, and they're always making over this little girl. And it was just very, very creepy. I mean, the family didn't have much. They didn't, at times they didn't have electricity in the house. They had problems with rats in this house. If you went in the dining room, there was no table. There was a foosball table. There was just, you know, she had to every day bring her bicycle into the house because somebody would steal it in the neighborhood if she didn't. And, you know, she had a rough life. And, you know, I know her mother said, oh, she had a great life. Well, I'm sure there were happy moments in that life, but there was a lot of challenges in that life as well.
Yeah. Is that why you decided to cover that part in your guys' podcast, the WVIK suspect convictions, mm-hmm. to kind of highlight what Jennifer Lewis had gone through leading up to?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, I've been a journalist for a little over 30 years now, and one of the things that really upsets me, and I've noticed over and over again, if it's a child of a wealthy person, like Elizabeth Smart or JonBenet Ramsey or whoever that goes up missing or is killed, the media is all over it. But if it's a child of coming out of poverty, it's a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
And I believe all lives count. And I believe that her life mattered. Yes, she was a child who grew up in very difficult circumstances. Yes, she was a child that was learning disabled. Yes, there were things about her that might make some people say that her life wasn't as valuable as others. I don't believe that. I believe that her life mattered. And, you flash forward 30 years. I had, worked for newspapers for 20 years. I ran a national news service for 3 years. And then I ran a statewide news service for 4. And the company I'm working for is going through a restructuring. And, I wasn't keen on where I was going to get moved to. And I'm talking to my wife, and she says, "Well, what have you always wanted to do?" And I said, "I've always wanted to write a book about this murder case I covered as a young reporter." She said, "Well, then do it, Life's too short to, be doing something you don't like." So, quit my job, and started working on the book, and I had never listened to a podcast before. Well, there was my church puts out a podcast of the pastor's sermons, and in case you liked it so much the first time, you could listen to it the second time. I didn't do that very often, but but I really never had listened to podcasts. And my wife's a veterinarian, and we were driving up to the Quad Cities from Springfield, Illinois, to pick up a puppy in Kelowna, and I said, I keep hearing about this thing called. Drawing a blank here. The big NPR podcast, Adnan Syed.
Serial.
I keep hearing about the Serial thing and these podcast things. It's, Serial at the time was the most listened to podcast in history. I think it still may be.
Probably.
And I said, I never listened to one before, but, maybe we should listen to this on the way up. So we're listening to it, and it's a fascinating tale, and after about 2 or 3 hours on the road listening to it, I finally turned to my wife and I said, this is an interesting case, but my murder is so much more interesting than this one. And so, make a long story short, since I lived in the Quad Cities, almost 20 years before, I still knew some people, and I called up WVIK, and I made the pitch for, why don't we go into partnership and produce a podcast on this?
Yeah.
Before the week was out, Jay Pierce had signed off on the idea and assigned a producer to work with me for 7 or 8 months.
Wow.
And we produced it, and the podcast became number 2 in the world on iTunes.
That's incredible.
It was a very compelling story, and I continued to cover the case. Went to trial twice, once with a hung jury, and then again, and I sat through the trial and produced daily reports out of there. It's something that's been with me for a long time. If you look at my basement, it's full of these banker boxes, full of all the files I've accumulated in this case. So as I write the book, I can draw upon them. I've traveled all over the U.S. The stepfather's missing. He was the alternate suspect in the case. Went down into New Orleans where he was living last and being homeless, and hunted for him underneath the viaducts and interstate exchanges and everything else with a flashlight in the middle of the night and a mugshot. You seen this guy lately? And these homeless people, yeah, that's Ace. Yeah, he hangs out. I mean, they all knew him.
Yeah.
And so I spent like 3 days down there interviewing people, and they all remembered him, and we never found him. And he's never been found by anybody since. And then we, I went to the town and small town in Mississippi where Stanley Liggins grew up, and interviewed people who knew him, found out about his past, talked to his family members. Some of them live here in the Quad Cities, some of them live in East St. Louis, some of them live down in Mississippi and other places. I've talked to a lot of the family, and even they are divided on whether he's innocent or guilty.
Really?
His one brother said, I said to him, do you think that your brother, that Stanley did this? And he just looked at me and said, I just don't know. And I'm thinking to myself, if somebody came up to me and said, Scott, was your brother Dan capable of, sexually assaulting a 10-year-old girl, strangling her, tossing her body into the school playground and dousing her with gasoline and setting her on fire, I would just say, hell no, that's not what my brother would do.
Yeah.
And when you get, well, I don't really know if he did it or would have done it, I'm like, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
That's insane. Why, so this was a question I was thinking of, because you followed this case so exclusively for so long. Mm-hmm. I mean, from the very beginning, almost to the, pretty much the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Why stick with it? I know you, obviously, that very first day, that very first night was so, shocking, and it was horrific.
It was traumatizing. I mean, I went home, when you're a reporter, especially when I was a police reporter for a couple of years here, you see a lot of horrible things.
Yeah.
That was the only thing I could remember that stuck with me so bad I couldn't sleep. Went on for days. I mean, I was just really traumatized about it. I mean, there was the next morning when I got up, it was strange because it's the only story I've ever done in 30-some years in the business where I felt a community trauma. Because you got to remember, this got broadcast into everybody's home.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, walking through the apartment complex, and parents are like, not letting their kids leave the house. They're just terrified because there's literally a child killer on the loose in the community. And I never seen a crime affect a community that profoundly before or since. It was a horrendous thing. But not only that, I mean, to witness these things and to see the community trauma and the pressure that was put on the police officers and the county attorney's office and everybody else to solve this case, to get somebody off the streets, was just enormous. And of course, that raises questions. Did they cut corners? Did they get the right guy?
Yeah.
I mean, it was very much a circumstantial case, which most murder cases are, by the way.
But, yeah.
It was difficult.
And to stay with it, though, was it just that shocking and compelling that it's I can't let this go. I want to see this to the very end.
I want to see this to the very end was certainly true. I also was curious about the veracity of some of the witnesses. There was one guy who was a cellmate of Liggins, and he said that in the first trial, he said Liggins was tried 4 times. The first 2 trials, he testified that Stanley Liggins confessed to him in his cell. And I thought, I've always thought, why would this hardened criminal Stanley Liggins confess to his cellmate who he didn't get along with that he killed this girl? I mean, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And this guy, Frank Rising, who was a cellmate, is a career criminal. He's been in and out of prisons in Iowa and Nebraska. for his entire life. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to do some shoe leather reporting, you know. Frank's been just gotten released from the Nebraska prison, and I knew he had some relatives in the Quad Cities. I knew he had some relatives in Sioux City. I decided to drive out to Sioux City and just start knocking on doors with people who had the same last name. And I drive out there, and this is something you don't see happen very much anymore because newsrooms don't have the budgets they used to do this kind of reporting. But I'm on my own, I can do this.
Yeah.
So I go up to this house out in kind of the middle of nowhere near Sioux City, and there's elk running around. I didn't know there were elk in Iowa, you know. And I said that to my wife. She said, "Well, you know they're in South Dakota." I go, "Yeah." "Well, you know, South Dakota borders Iowa." And I go, "Well, yeah. The elk don't know not to cross the line." I go, "Yeah, okay, dear, okay." And so I walk up this door and I say, and this nice family answers the door. And I said, "Hey, I'm looking for Frank Rising. I'm wondering if any of you are related to him." And in unison, they all say, "No." I found the right family, you know, and I look in, and I see this guy lounging on the sofa, and I say, "Nice try, I've seen his picture, you look just like him, you're his brother, aren't you?" "Yeah, I'm his brother." I said, "Well, let me explain why I'm here." And I come in, and I'm explaining why I'm here, and he goes, "Okay, let me call him." So he calls him on the phone, and he goes, "This reporter wants to talk to him." "I don't want to talk to any reporter." And they're going back and forth, and finally I just have him hand the phone over to me, and I said, "Okay, you know, hey, I just want to hear the story. You know, I promise it won't be more than 15 minutes, you know." And he goes, "Nah, I don't want to talk to any reporter." I said, "Okay, guy, I'll tell you the truth. I saw on your record that you've been married." He goes, "Yeah." "Okay, I drove all the way to Sioux City, Iowa, from Springfield, Illinois. And if I don't come back with an interview, my wife is just going to kill me. She's going to just say, 'You wasted 2 days. You could have been with the family when you could have, and you instead drove out there and didn't even get an interview.'" I said, "I don't want to deal with that. Can you appreciate that?" "Okay, fine. Come on down to the construction site where I'm working." So I drive down to downtown Sioux City. And it's at this point, it's about 9 o'clock at night. It's pitch black, and he's there troweling some concrete with some other guys. And he said, "Just wait till I'm done here." And he gets done. So we go out in the middle of this parking lot. It's just the two of us. And I said, "You know, tell me a story here." And he goes, "Well, I really didn't want to testify against him." "Okay, why?" He goes, "Well, no snitch." "Okay, well, what happened?" And he goes, "Well, it's like this." He said, they put me in the same cell with him for like a month, and then all of a sudden they pull me out of the cell, these detectives, and they take me in this room, and they throw down this picture of this burned child in front of me, and they said, "If you don't testify that he confessed to you, we're going to charge you as accessory after the fact of murder." And he goes, "I don't want to get charged with accessory after the fact of murder." So I just said, "Sure, I'll do it." I said, "Well," and he said, "I told the truth, though." You know, and I'm like, "Well, that's an interesting story." So we got this all on tape, and we broadcast it. You can imagine it created quite a stir. And then when he got brought in for the next trial, I just wanted to get rid of that reporter. That's why I just told him that story. And yeah, well, come on, guy. You know. And there was another woman. There was a woman who was also a witness in the case. And she was a key witness in the case. Her name was Wanda Hughes. Her name still is Wanda Hughes, for that matter. And she had looked out the window of a house she was in about two blocks from the fire. She said, and she said that she saw taillights there, and she said she'd recognize those taillights anywhere. And okay, and so it had come. She was the key witness, and she became the key witness in this case. During the first two trials, they rolled in the back half of Stanley Liggins' car. and
which is just crazy. I've never seen half of a car in a courtroom ever. The pictures are insane.
Yes, they are. I mean, they're really crazy. But the thing is, the jury didn't know that it was a car. They had it shrouded like a statue, the whole thing. And this woman takes a stand, and Bill Davis, who's a fabulous trial attorney, walks in, and he walks up to this shrouded object, and he says to the woman, "Tell me about this car you saw," and she starts to tell it, and he pulls the shroud from the back end of the car, and the jurors just gasp, like, "Oh, that's what it is." And then they turn the lights off in the courtroom, and they turn the lights on the car, and she says, "I'd recognize those taillights anywhere. Those were the taillights I saw." And, so it's like, wow. So 30 years later, I go knocking on her door. And I said, she's telling me about it, and I'm sitting on the front porch, her husband's mowing the yard, her grandkids are running around, and there's a bee flying around our heads, and I said to her, we're talking, and she's telling me in about, this, why she did what she said, and how she saw it, and then I said to her, "Now, I got to ask you, had you ever had a relationship with anybody in the police department before all this?" No, not at all. And I was questioning her a little bit more. And all of a sudden, she's ordering me off the porch and yelling at me. And which proves the old adage about journalism majors isn't true. You know, how do you get a journalism major to leave your front porch? Pay for the pizza, And it's like... So,
I love it. That's what
you said. She kind of chases me off the porch, and I say, fine, and I come back like a year later and see if she's willing to talk, and she remembers me, and she's, doesn't want to talk.
Of course.
But it turns out this woman had been a paid police informant in more than 80 other cases involving the same police officers that worked this case. And he stopped and think, what are the odds that this woman who just happened to see this case also happened to, you don't know. So there were some real questions about those two particular witnesses. Now, I'll be very honest with you. I think Stanley Liggins is guilty. I can say that, I think, fairly, having sat through the trials and gone through all the evidence. And, there's a lot of stuff that didn't come out in the trials that should have. He was arrested, or when he was a juvenile, he got into trouble, but never convicted, involving the sexual assault of an elderly woman in Mississippi with dementia, and she couldn't testify against him. He went to prison for an armed robbery for 7 years.
I knew that one.
When he was in prison, he was accused. He was a very violent individual. He bit correction officers and attacked them. He did some other things. He stabbed an unarmed man repeatedly and was able to get acquitted by a jury on self-defense for murder.
I think I read that.
Now, his claim was that the guy disarmed the guy and then stabbed him. But even if you disarmed the guy, he's still unarmed, but...
Technicality, whatever you want to call it.
But he was accused by one inmate of trying to rape him in the showers. He was, just a lot of horrific things. And if you read his psych profile, he's a scary dude. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I probably should have put this in. I mean, 3 days after I was at the murder scene, they arrested him.
Yeah.
And I wrote him a letter to the Rock Island County Jail asking for an interview.
Simple request.
Yeah. And he calls the newsroom and he says,
I'll talk to a reporter, but I don't want to talk to a man reporter. I want to talk to a female reporter. And I said to the editor, you can't let somebody dictate, you know, what gender or what race or whatever of a reporter is. And she goes, okay, fine. You can go, Scott, but take a woman with you just in case he won't talk to you. And the reporter that goes with me is Jennifer DeWitt. She's still at the Times, an excellent reporter. And I go in, and there's this sheet of plexiglass between us, and I pick up the phone, and I'm talking to him, and Jennifer's sitting behind me, and he's saying some kind of crude things about, you know, women and sexual things, and I'm like, oh, this is creepy. And it was the most terrifying interview I've ever had, and I interviewed lots of criminals in my life, and interviewed people from all walks of life in 30-some years. He is the only one that I can think of that really got under my skin. He just spooked the crap out of me. I mean, two or three years later, I went to the movie theater, and I saw this movie called Silence of the Lambs, where Jodie Foster's interviewing Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
And I go, that's exactly what I felt.
Yeah.
With that plexiglass. I mean, it was exactly what I felt at the time. He was really a spooky guy. In fact, after I got done with the interview, then a Channel 8 reporter came in a few hours later, Chris Miner.
Of course.
And interviewed him and as well. And then the next day, Lisa Tirado with Channel 4 came in and interviewed him, and then, a reporter with the Dispatch Argus went in, and his first name's Tom, and I think it's Tom Swike, who came in, and he interviewed him, and I was talking to Tom, you know, 30 years later, and I said, what do you remember of that interview? During the whole interview. Mind you, this is a guy professing his innocence and trying to tell everybody that they got the wrong man. And Tom goes in there right after the Channel 4 reporter leaves, and he goes into graphic detail about what he wants to do to that Channel 4 reporter. And I'm like, this guy is really creepy. The other thing that didn't come out in the trials is that why did the police focus on him right away? Well, he was out on bond for sexually assaulting another 10-year-old girl a month before Jennifer's murder.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they're going to focus in on him because he was somebody who was out over at that house every day. But that never came out. And he had a girlfriend. And he lived with some of the time and on and off. It came out that there was an allegation that he was sexually abusing her 3-year-old girl. And so you've got all these allegations of sexual abuse surrounding this guy. But that never can get before the jury because it's considered overly prejudicial. And so am I skeptical about some of the testimony that was presented in the trial? Yes.
Yeah.
But I know the things that weren't presented in the trial that more than pushed me over the edge that, yeah, they got the right guy here.
Yeah.
He's a scary, scary man. And one of the creepiest things I saw was when I was sitting there and the jury comes back and a few months ago and they find him guilty and he's just sitting there. Not a fleck of emotion, just stone cold, and I'm like, wow. I mean, it's just
creepy.
It's very creepy.
Just creepy.
I've never encountered a person like him in my entire life.
Gosh. That's crazy, though, that, you know, a jury wasn't able to hear any of that, and especially because while it might have been circumstantial, you know, in some sense of the word, it shows a pattern. It shows a pattern of, you know, predatory, you know, tendencies. It shows a pattern of, you know,
And that's what the prosecution argued. It said this is a pattern of behavior. And the other thing that was strange is if you laid down the picture of this girl from Milan that he sexually assaulted a month before Jennifer, and you laid down Jennifer's picture next to him, they could be sisters. They looked just alike. And they were the same age. There was, there's a pattern of behavior here is the argument. And, oh, when he went to trial for the other case, the little girl testified against him. He's walking out of the courtroom in Rock Island, and he looks over at the girl's mother, and he says, I'm going to kill that little girl when I get a chance.
Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, that was what she's testified to. And, you know, this is a scary, scary man. I'll be the first to tell you, I'm liberal about some things. I think there's a lot of people in prison that shouldn't be. They should be in drug treatment. They should be in other programs. They should be in some kind of diversionary program or whatever. Somebody like Stanley Liggins should never get out of prison.
Yeah.
He's a scary, scary man.
That's crazy, though. That really is. And for four juries, in a sense,
yeah.
What was his first one, 93?
First trial, the crime happened in 1990. The first trial was
1993. Yeah.
That guilty verdict was overturned because it had come out that Stanley Liggins was providing cocaine to
the mom
to sell.
Yeah.
And they said, and the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, that's overly prejudicial. That the jurors will think less of him because he's a drug dealer. And they also said, never mind, that's how the family knew him. I mean,
yeah.
It was the nature of the relationship between them.
Yeah.
And also the Iowa Supreme Court said, there have been so much media coverage of this, that it probably should have been a change of venue. Which actually I could buy into, to be honest with you, because it was a media circus when this happened. And do that. So they moved the case, they had a new trial in Dubuque. And I don't know if you remember this, or this was before your time, but...
It was 96, 97?
It was 95, 96.
I was 3 or 4 years old.
Okay, well, this is the era when there was a bunch of cross-burnings up in Dubuque.
Okay.
Dubuque, as you probably know, is the most homogenous major city and one of the most homogenous states in the Union.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very white. And the mayor of Dubuque had said, we need to bring more diversity to this community. Maybe we should recruit families to come in of color, give the community a little more of a texture.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't go over very well with some people there. And there started to be a handful of black families that were already in the community and lived there many years. They started burning crosses in front of their homes. It was really scary. And then in the middle of this mess, they moved the Stanley Liggins trial to Dubuque. And of course, Jennifer, the victim, was white. Stanley Liggins is black. It's got huge racial overtones. And he draws an all-white jury, which was not surprising in Dubuque. And Stanley Liggins stands up and starts hollering at the jury and swearing at the jury, and has gone down and among local attorneys, he's the only man. Can I use this terminology?
Of course.
He's the only person to motherfucker a jury in the...
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
And ironically, it went to the jury, and they took several days to find a guilty verdict. And so he goes back to prison. He's got all these appeals. And then it comes out that one of the key witnesses against him had been a paid police informant. Mm-hmm. That was never disclosed. And that's a pretty big deal. And then it comes out that there were some police reports that were never turned over. Now, Bill Davis insists that they were turned over. He says they got lost when they moved from one defense attorney to another. But the Iowa Supreme Court, or Iowa Appellate Court at the time, said... ruled otherwise. So those two things, he gets a new trial, and they decide to do a change of venue to Waterloo, and which is the most racially diverse community in Iowa. It's a by Iowa standards, it's racially diverse. It's 10% African American, which, you know. And they had a couple African Americans on the jury, and but the jury deadlocked going through it, and they voted 9-3 for acquittal. And so they decided to go back to trial again, and the jury pretty promptly came back with a conviction, and
it was a long time.
It was a long time, 30 years. I mean, this case is going. I never have covered a trial or something that came back after 30 years. Can you imagine? Most of the witnesses were dead.
Yeah.
You had, the people you were bringing, I felt really old because I'm sitting there, and, I had been a really young reporter at the time, and I remember these really rough and tough detectives who wouldn't put up with crap from anybody, and they're coming in walkers, and I'm like, oh God, I'm just ancient. It's like, it was incredible.
Yeah. Have you stayed in touch with Jennifer's family throughout this time?
I've interviewed her mother many times. She has a brother that's in prison in Fort Madison right now. I've interviewed him on the phone. Her biological father lives up in the Twin Cities. He never came down for the funeral. He wouldn't talk for the thing, for the podcast. Stayed in touch. And,
Because the way that you've explained before is that while you never knew Jennifer, mm-hmm. you definitely have.
I have a real sense for who she is.
Yeah.
And Jennifer's godmother, Mary Rockwell, and I have gotten to know each other very well. And Jennifer, Mary was really a rock in that child's life, and she's told me a lot about her. This tomboy who was loved to scrap with everybody. She loved to ride her bike. She loved her dog Bowser. She knew all the kids in the neighborhood. Was all over at everybody's house. She was a very vivacious, very engaging child. I've interviewed her teachers. I've interviewed a lot of people. They all have stories to tell. One of them was one of the teacher's aides was telling about taking a class over to the Adler to see a play and holding Jennifer's hand, and Jennifer bit her arm because she didn't like her holding her hand. There's just a lot of stories to go. Talking to this teacher's aide 30 years later, she's like crying during the interview, remembering Jennifer. It's just a tragic story. It just sticks with me. What a horrible waste.
Yeah.
Jennifer, if she was alive today, would be in her 40s. She'd probably be a mom. She'd have
a life.
A life.
Yeah.
And,
I think that's the hardest thing when you try to piece together some of these cases with children. So not only Jennifer Lewis, but you look at Trudy Appleby, you look at Amber Sutton. Mm-hmm. They're young, young kids.
Yeah, and I was here when both of those cases happened too.
Just to imagine them being 30, 40, 50 years old. It's hard to think of that because we only know them as these kids, because that's when mm-hmm. their life stopped, unfortunately.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody the other day, and he was saying he's going to a retirement party for a Davenport police officer, and he told me who it was. I go, wow, he's the only one left on the force from when I covered it.
Really?
That's how much of a turnover there's been. That's how long it's been.
Yeah.
It's been a long time, but I'd still like to interview Stanley Liggins. I'd still like to go into the prison and interview him. He hasn't agreed to it. I'll keep being persistent because I'd like to hear his explanation. I mean, there's a lot of questions out there that need to be answered.
Yeah. And, of course, I mean, he might talk.
He might. He did talk to me before.
Yeah. I mean, he's done it once.
Oh, I do have a funny story about that.
Oh, no. I love it.
Because you're an executive producer, so you know what newsrooms are like. And you know how harried these places are. And so I go in and I interview Stanley Liggins. And then, of course, I get talked to detectives who work the case who rebut what he has to say.
Of course.
And I think it's a pretty good story. And we run it on the front page of the Quad City Times. And like 2 or 3 weeks later, a good friend of mine comes over to me and she says, "Oh, are you all worried?" "Worried about what?" "Well, Stanley Liggins called here and made threats against you." "What?" "Well, she talked to that editor over there." So I walk over and I said, "Did Stanley Liggins call and threaten me?" "Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. It happened like 3 weeks ago." And I go, "Well, what did he say?" Let me think. "He said he hated that story, and as soon as he got out of prison, he was going to kick your ass." And I go, "Thank you for sharing that with me so promptly, you know."
Not now, you're just like, is he out? Like, you're scared? Like, I would be.
It was just kind of like, you know, a guy that's in prison or in jail awaiting trial for this, probably one of the most horrible crimes ever to hit the Quad Cities, and he calls and threatens a Pacific reporter, and you forget to tell him? I mean, come on.
That's miraculous. That is one of those where, you know, the running joke about being in journalism, you know, we're in the business of communication, but we can't communicate with nothing.
That's for sure. It's like, oh, gosh. So, yeah.
And with suspect convictions, because, I mean, I you know, I listened to it and I watched, you know, I read over a lot of the things that, you know, were written about it and everything. And, you know, and I'm doing the same thing, I feel like, you know, I don't want to glorify what's going on. I don't want to shed light on these criminals. That's not the goal. It's obviously to be able to give a voice to to the voiceless, to those who were victims, to those to remind people that these happened. You know, the Quad Cities, you know, yeah, we have shots fired calls, and yeah, we have, you know, car thefts. You know, we have these, in a sense, petty crimes nowadays. But, you know, there has been some awful, awful shit that has gone down here.
And it has.
And to remind people of that, but then also to remind people that, you know, these victims need to have their voices heard still. These stories shouldn't go away.
They should not go away at all. And these people, these kids need to be remembered.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'll touch my life, you know, to the day I die. I mean, it's something that changed me. And I know that sounds dramatic, but it really did change me. I mean, and I don't know anybody who was there that night that didn't get changed. I mean, Dennis Kern, he was the lieutenant in charge of the identification division for Davenport at the time. And he was there that night. And I'm talking to him. He's now with the Iowa, he's a criminalist now with the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation. And I was interviewing him, and he goes, "You know, I was testifying in a trial. And I had a flashback during the trial." He said, "I heard about Vietnam veterans having flashbacks," but he said, "I always kind of blew it off as much a hooey." And then he goes, "And I'm in trial, and they're cross-examining me." And he said, "Suddenly I just have this flashback that I'm back at the scene." You know, because, you know, he was standing maybe with his face maybe a foot from the body examining it, you know, for evidence. And He was changed by that event. I was talking to Don Schaefer. He went on to become the Davenport police chief, and he was in charge of the scene that night. You know, and he was telling me it changed him. I mean, he can never get out of his mind the look of those eyes looking back up at him. I talked to Kevin Murphy, who's since passed away in the last year or so. he could never get past what he saw that night.
Yeah.
I mean, it haunted him for the rest of his life. Everybody I know that was there was affected. It was, you know, it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I hope I ever do see.
So now that Stanley Liggins is locked away,
uh-huh.
Now that it's been 30 years, you've obviously now covered with suspect convictions the case.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still planning on writing the book?
Yes.
You're still in the process of that?
Yeah, I got to do a few more interviews. I have volumes of material, and I just started to start writing. And as you can appreciate, even though I write a lot and I've been doing it for 30 years, it's a little intimidating starting a book.
Yeah.
But I'm excited about it. I think it's got a lot of potential. There's some stories that need to be told. I mean, one of the questions I think we have to ask ourselves is, what environment creates a Stanley Liggins?
Mm-hmm.
You know? What was his home life like? What was it like? How did prison affect him? How did different things that happened in his life leading up to this? And you look at lives like Jennifer Lewis, you know, looking at how can we prevent this sort of thing from happening? I mean, long before there was a Stanley Liggins involved in her life, there was Iowa Department of Children and Family Services was involved in checking out her home life. There was questions they had. There was other... I mean, this wasn't like coming out of nowhere. There was issues. There's things that we need to really look at. But I would really... I'm excited about doing the book. Wondering where am I going to find the time, which shocks me, because I thought I had oodles of time. But I do a lot of other things. And of course, you know, I'm working on a new podcast, too. I'm looking at... a school shooting that happened in Santa Fe, Texas.
Yeah.
10 children were killed, 8 children were killed, and 2 teachers were killed, and 13 more people were wounded. And I'm trying to look at the nature of why these mass shootings happen. It's going to be a new podcast coming out this fall, so we're looking forward to that. I haven't come up with a name for it yet, but we're working hard on it.
That's incredible, though. I mean, your career for the past 30 years is just something that, you know, I think any journalist would want to emulate, no matter how painful that obviously has been with, especially Jennifer Lewis, but to be able to have these stories and have these interviews and to be able to do the things that you're doing, even now, I just think it's just incredible. And so, truly, truly, thank you for sitting down with me. Thank you for talking with me. Thank you for driving up from Springfield and being able to have this conversation, because I feel like, you know, there's facts mm-hmm. that have been obviously out in the trial, you know, beforehand, you know, with the times and mm-hmm. our systems back here, you know, where we can, you know, lay out the facts and that. But, you know, mm-hmm. it's the journalist's stories. You know, a lot of people... You know, they want to claim fake news. They want to claim, you know, that, you know, journalism is dead. But I feel like to continue to do these stories is even more important nowadays.
Journalism is just changing.
Yeah.
And we know a little bit about how it's changing. We don't know what it's changing to yet, but we know it's going to be there. We know it's going to, but it's going to be, it's evolving into something else. It'll be fascinating and exciting to see what it evolves into.
Yeah. And so I think to continue to tell Jennifer's story, but to continue to tell everything is of the utmost importance. So thank you again for everything with this.
Well, I love being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Allow your imagination to be piqued by stories that are brought to life through captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. As an Audible member, you'll be able to keep your heart rate up month after month because you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. If you're in the mood for a shocking psychological thriller, check out None of This Is True by Lisa Jewell. Embrace brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.